This is the Long Range Financial Planning Commission. It's September 21st, 1995. The commission meeting will be held at the University Lake Building, the Butrovich Building in Fairbanks, as well as the Governor's Conference Room in Juneau. This will be a video conference, and it will be chaired by Brian Rogers, and it will commence at 1800 hours today.
Chairman.
Go ahead, Judy.
I thought that one thing that would help me again is for everybody to talk about, because I kind of lost track of what Mary, when you had that legislation drafted, you know, what your idea was at the time, and have each of us maybe talk just for a minute about, get kind of move away from the composite and kind of talk for a minute again about how we thought this might go together and what our kind of main concerns were, because what we may have done is move too fast into a composite before we had individual segments satisfied. And just kind of revisit that for not a whole long time, but just kind of go through some of the things we visited early to make sure we didn't lose the picture here.
Okay, is your preference, Judy, that we do that before we get into the scenarios and federal and other funds?
I don't care. I have no preference. Go ahead and do it. Go ahead and do what you planned, and then maybe we can go through the composite once to make sure we all understand it, what the figures mean, and then revisit what we tried to accomplish as individuals.
Okay, Brad, let me turn to you and ask you to show us where we are.
Okay. I whipped this up this afternoon. As usual, we had the technical difficulties. I tried to get it into a workbook, and lost all my links. But I think I got it fixed. Basically what I did was, the concern last night was that we weren't comparing apples and oranges, that we wanted to have exactly the same revenues, exactly the same expenditures and so forth, between the two approaches. So I took our composite scenario and I smoothed it a little bit. Basically, it's the same as last night, the same revenue sources. I took the dividend and I kept them at the 96 level until they rose again up above that, which happens in FY 2000.
So you didn't
use... I balanced the budget. Excuse me?
So you didn't use the Rieger thing where it actually start going down?
That's right. I just arbitrarily kept them constant at the 96 level for, 5 years here, just so they wouldn't, or 4 years, just so they wouldn't go down. We got plenty of money. There's no problem as far as kicking off revenues to balance the budget. And in fact, this balances it a year earlier. And then we took all the excess revenues and dumped them into the permanent fund. Now, one important change here I made was we did a 40-30-30 plan. We took a $40 million cut in FY97 and a $30 million cut in 98 and 99, the nominal dollars. So the $100 million total over 3 years. And then I balanced it out through our time period here. And, just like last night, we put in an income tax early on in 01 and on out into FY10 to make sure the thing balanced. We dumped all the excess revenues into the permanent fund. And the one minor change from last night was we didn't wait for 5 years to dump the CBR into the permanent fund. We dumped it in every year and thereby got some increased earnings, some more compounding and so forth. End up with $38 billion fund in FY 2010 in nominal dollars. The ERA, we let that go up each year and then deposit it in every 5 years into the permanent fund. Okay, then if you turn to the endowment scenario, I took exactly these taxes, the same thing. I just copied the entire amount of conventional revenues exactly as they are in the composite scenario and dumped it into the endowment scenario. The only change you'll see here that's different is the the lifting the export ban, which is $20 million. That was already included in the resource revenues in Hugh's spreadsheet there. I don't have... This thing runs off of your spreadsheet, is what it does. And and then I did exactly the same thing with the permanent fund dividend, let it go up. And it's like Roger said last night, it doesn't really work at 9%. It'll work at a higher rate of return on the permanent fund, but we run persistent deficits at a 9% rate of return. And that's as good as I've gotten it so far. I'm going to send my models to ICER tomorrow. I'm going to email them to them. I've just about got them cleaned up enough for somebody else to look at them. And they can, check it out, make sure I haven't misspecified anything. That's always your greatest fear, is that you've had a logical problem somewhere. But to the best of my ability right now, this is what I'm showing.
So the permanent fund doesn't take it, the dividend program doesn't take a hit at all here. People pay taxes.
That's right.
People pay taxes, and we cut spending so that local government taxes go up.
Well, no, that isn't entirely accurate. The permanent fund stays flat for 4 years, the dividend amount, which would make the dividend go down slightly.
Which are you talking about, the endowment or the composite?
Both. In both.
The versions that we have, Brad, are so small that we can hardly read them. So you're going to have to make sure you give us numbers.
Okay, it would stay at $582 million, which is our estimate of what the status quo is, for 4 years.
And then, Brad, does that mean that in 01, is that when the Rieger plan would be fully implemented?
No, the Rieger plan would be fully implemented in 05. Under a 9% scenario, the Rieger plan with the dividend would start to increase in 01. What I did was just hold them constant at 96 level for 4 years, and then when it started to increase above the 96 level, I let it go.
I see. So all you raise the floor, but not the ceiling.
That's right.
Okay.
The concern that I have about the Rieger plan is that I don't have any problem with Steve's desire to translate this into real dollars, but I think that we would have real difficulty if we enacted it, because people are going to be very confused between real and nominal. We all understand nominal, but I'm not sure that, as a matter of political and social acceptance, people are going to be able to deal with the two-number system, sort of a dual accounting system.
I think that probably the best way to characterize that is to let people know that the main feature is inflation shooting first. I think that probably conveys the heart of it from that standpoint. Is that what you're going to answer? How does it make it clear for the public what this is accomplishing?
No, I think that over time we're going to see a growing disparity in terms of acceptance of the concept of reporting everything in real dollars instead of nominal dollars, as far as people are concerned. And there is likely to be some degree of concern on the part of the general public as to which, how the inflation proofing actually is calculated and that kind of thing. It seems to me that incorporating such sort of esoteric concepts into legislation, which is supposed to be designed for general public acceptance, is hazardous. I'm not going to make a big think about it, but I just think that we should consider that as appropriate as it may be from an economist or an accountant viewpoint, to make calculations with respect to, the real dollars and discount for inflation. I'm not sure that the public acceptance is going to be as great, and I have some concerns that they will become suspicious about the integrity of the fund.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
Can I, okay, now I want to make sure I understand this on both of these. On both of them, the permanent fund dividend stays the same and begins to increase? or just in the composite scenario?
Both.
Both are exactly the same.
Okay.
The permanent fund dividend amount, the amount dedicated to dividends stays the same, which means that with population growth, the dividend declines slightly.
All right, but it doesn't take a hit. Okay, and yet, and both of them also have...
That's wrong, Judy. It's in effect a cap on dividends for 4 years.
Yeah, and then it starts to grow again.
Yes. And well, it might not in per capita terms. I'm not sure. I haven't run that.
And the second thing is that there's an income tax right away while the permanent fund...
Yeah.
For
no.
The second year, in the second
there's
year.
There's an income tax.
No.
No, there's an income tax in 2001. It begins at a very low rate.
Okay, and you're making this... Okay, in both of
the taxes that...
Yes.
The taxes that start in the first couple of years are just the ones that we had identified that we felt for policy reasons in place, alcohol, tobacco, and the motor fuel taxes.
Okay.
And then some increase in use.
Okay.
And those are the phasing that we had talked about at two meetings ago.
Okay, and then we have this 40-30-30 cut in both of them.
Yes.
That was something we were trying on for size, and I think all of us were feeling different levels of concern about what do we have to do, aside from what we need to do to close the fiscal gap, what do we have to do to convince the public that we are being more effective about what we do in services, and also taking a hard look at which things we should be considering, or as you put it, the value part of the increase. So this was just a cut at trying to see what you could do, spreading $100 million plus in a way that, this is sort of my rough idea of a way that you could, I think it's more achievable for us to spread it over 3 years than to try to do it all in the first year and then hold flat, because some of the things that we're working on right now will take 1, 2, or 3 years to be pulled fully realized savings.
Right.
So that those numbers could be adjusted. It was just a cut of how to spread it out a little bit.
Okay, and then you're making large deposits from the permanent fund earning reserve, the excess, into the permanent fund each year?
That's right.
The 40-30-30, as I look at it, what that turns into is a real per capita cut of about 5.5% the first year, 5% the second, and 5% the third. If we look at, we're assuming inflation is 3%, we were, in the base case, in addition to growing by inflation, we were growing by half of population growth, which was about half of 1.6, so a freeze represents about a 3.8% reduction. By adding this, we're bringing it up to a 5.4% reduction in real per capita terms. In nominal terms, it's about a 1% per year, 1.5% in the first year and closer to 1% in the other two. I don't know if that's going to be enough to satisfy people, but interestingly, it does hit the Hickel. Hickel talked about a 5% annual cut. He never said 5% of what, but this level of cut would achieve that goal of if it was 5% in terms of what it really means out there in buying power each of those 3 years. Brad, do I have
we're picking up a real buzz. Could you maybe move your microphone slightly farther away?
Is it better now?
It's about halfway in between with the work from the...
There. Is that better?
Better. Yeah, that takes out the buzz. Thanks.
Yeah, we seem to have... Your voices are also a little muddy. I'm not sure what's going on.
Maybe that's not our voices. Maybe that's our personality.
Brad, did I do the numbers right, or was the base case inflation plus half of population growth?
That's right.
So it is flattened. Yeah. So a flat level is about a 3.8% annual cut.
About 4%, yeah.
Judy, did you have another question?
Yeah. Well, no, I understand it. Let's go on to the other stuff because I want to talk about trade-offs here in a little bit.
Okay. Any other questions?
Brad? I don't know if I asked you before, but tomorrow, could you fax up to us your scenario projection number 4 and your endowment scenarios in larger type so we can read it?
Oh, sure.
Great. Thank you.
We're sort of caught, Brad, in the faxes we've gotten the last few days, at least the ones I've gotten, are big enough that they take a page plus an extended page so that all the titles go on a separate piece of paper, which means every time I have to hold up two sheets and make sure I got them in alignment. Now you fix that, but it's so small we can't read it.
Okay, I got it.
We're shrinking the fiscal gap.
That's good. Yes.
One thing I'd also like to see would be the projection of what the individual dividend would be under this scenario of holding it flat for the 4 years.
Okay.
Actually, Michael Wendler on one now.
Sure. Brad, in this composite, once we unfreeze the dividend pool, are we at the Rieger level?
Yes.
So that is below where we would have been in the base case?
Well, the base case now was at a 7 point something percent rate of return on the permanent fund. You all had me run this at 9% to compare apples and apples, right?
Right.
But isn't it still true that the dividend under what we're looking at now, the dividend is still less than would have been if the Rieger plan didn't go into effect? Is that true?
That's true. At a 7 point something percent rate of return, the dividend takes a sharper dive, no doubt about it. But there's enough revenue spinning off of this thing that you can still either scale down the dividend gradually or even probably keep it flat in the amount appropriated for dividends for quite a while until it starts rising again. You could do the same thing, it just takes a longer time.
On the spending side, we reduce $100 million below current year nominal levels in the first 3 years, and then we start growing again and inflation plus half of population growth.
That's correct.
One of the concerns I have, and I'm not sure just how to estimate what it is, we've discussed a couple of spending size reductions whose impacts are further out. And as example, we talked at last Saturday's meeting about setting up a new third-tier retirement system. The third-tier retirement system gives you almost nothing in year one. But out might have as much as a third or a half, maybe even more employees that it would be on the new pier, which should mean that the state's contribution rate for PERS and the state's contribution for the schools for PERS should be dropping. And I think the number becomes significant out there in 2005 and continues to grow in terms of what our savings are. In the same fashion, if we look at state health benefits compared with health benefits offered by an aggregate of other employers in Alaska, I think we have a fairly rich plan today. And while those plans have to be negotiated, and therefore we can't really do anything for the next 3 years on most of the health plans, to seek to hold the plan level and not allow inflation over a long period of time may be realistic. When I add those two together, we might be talking as much as $75 million a year savings out in FY05 and $100 million out in FY10 from various steps like that we take today, but that don't have an impact. I wonder if we should put into our spending plan a lower rate of annual growth after the first 3 years, in order, and say that the reason we believe we can go below the base case is we can see positions that need to be taken now, but whose payoffs are in the out years. That also gains us a lot.
Concerned that this commission is going to put out a long-range forecast based on a plan we recommended that shows the kind of growth rate we're showing. We're baseline budgeting, and I don't want to be in a position of endorsing that. So I agree with you that we should reflect the savings we're going to try to accomplish long range.
Should we also reflect, though, the additional expenses that we're anticipating? At some point, we have to acknowledge that we need to make some increased expenditures in some areas, that we decided that has to come at the expense of expenditures in other areas in order to bring the budget down now. But our base case our case now does not include any consideration for maintenance in the out years or for ongoing. And that's my only concern, that we need to acknowledge that we have some expenses that we are not really incurring, but that we should be incurring. On the point that you raised, Brian, I definitely don't want to back off the recommendations that we make for the kinds of changes you've described to be pursued and put in place, because we will need those savings in the years.
Yeah, I kind of have a problem getting that specific, talking about affecting employee retirement, affecting employee health insurance. And that just kind of sends a message to the whole state workforce that has an adverse effect on morale and productivity. I don't mind citing those kinds of examples along with other efficiencies that can be made in state government. But I think you're sending a whole different message to a whole different audience than what you intend.
Bruce, I agree. I think we need some other examples where we need to also change government. There are a number of things that we should do a lot differently than we've been doing it. So having that as the only example, I think, would also be a mistake.
Well, I have a draft. I don't know if my email work gets the draft of that section out to all of you. Did you get that piece or not?
Which one is that?
I sent something on spending cuts, Melissa. If not, I can fax the hard copy.
If you sent it to Melissa on the email, if you sent it to Melissa on the email today, she's out sick.
Oh.
And I can't get
the email.
Email
doesn't tell you when somebody's sick. Well, I could fax hard copies to you if you like.
Okay.
I have pieces of the budget puzzle, spending cuts, reserves, and local state government relations.
Okay, let me find out the fax number right here. Do you want to do it now or?
What about
tomorrow?
Well, you tell me when. Pardon?
The fax number in Fairbanks is 474-5934.
Funds and say, here's what's in all the funds. capital spending funds that are set up by statute for a purpose, et cetera. We kind of walk through not every single fund, but each grouping of funds, and give dollar amounts for the totals in each category. And then make some specific recommendations for changes in how we show spending with a package of recommendations we think to be included in the FY97 budget cycle, and then another package that would be in the FY98 cycle. The 97 things that I would be recommending is that we show in our spending plans and all of our comparisons general funds, permanent funds, income, federal funds, interagency receipts, corporate receipts, so that all of that would be compared for FY96 or 97, that we separately show, we're working on a design of how this book is clear, separately show which of those have an impact on the fiscal gap. So in other words, we have to peel apart the ones that are so restrictive that you can't
right.
change the fiscal gap with them from the others.
Right.
That be part of the 97 package as well. That we mentioned that AHSC is now subject to the Budget Act, and it should have the same level of review that departments get. And there's one other thing I'm forgetting, that package. And then in 98, I would propose that we close out all of the inactive funds. Brian has suggested that we consider selling off any of the loan portfolios if it's a phased-out loan program or not issuing new loans under a particular revolving loan fund, that we could consider selling off the others so that we don't continue to incur the administrative costs, and that we establish a three-year time frame during which every single account in state government, every one of these funds, evaluated, would be given a substantive policy review, determine whether we should keep that fund or whether it would be better to get out of that business and use the money for other purposes. Just my rough look at it is I thought it was probably a little ambitious to try to do that in 2 years or 1 year, because there are some big chunks of policy decision out there. I thought it was certainly realistic to see. You might want to try to do that faster, but that you'd end up sort of doing the equivalent of a sunset review of each of these funds within 3 years. That was sort of the outline of what I was thinking, and then the appendix, we could actually attach Nancy's chart that shows the funds grouped by type, the June 30th balance, the appropriations for FY96, and some notes that describe whether it's an inactive fund or explains a little bit about why a particular fund, how it was, why it exists.
And then how did you think we ought to show those funds on the projections?
Scenario here. I don't have any good ideas for how to do that within this context now. I really don't. I'm open to suggestions that anybody else has.
Go ahead, Emily.
We are in the 97 budget, we are going to be displaying a lot more summary information about those. We'll be giving a summary of loan performance and so forth for all these funds. But trying to figure out how to put things like ADA and all the revolving loan funds into this scenario.
I don't think it's going to serve our purposes well try to rope all of those funds in to this particular scenario, but I think that it will serve our purposes if we do something like Annalita is suggesting, that in the budget process section of the report, we deal pretty explicitly and bluntly with the problem that all of these corporate entities and various funds have created in terms of having kind of a runaway situation, lack of accountability. I think that if we deal with them that way and you follow through with your, you know, in your budget projection, the statement that all of this will be reviewed thoroughly within 3 years, I'm not sure that the public is going to be all that upset about it. I think that what they're really going to be upset about are the, you know, your basic meat and potatoes programs like education and transportation.
Fran, we're working, I farmed part of this out to Marta Franco to try to pictorially represent that part of the budget over which we have control. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. Is there's this, you know, all these corporations, all this quasi-public agencies and so forth that actually fit into the appropriations bill, but the fiscal gap only is that part of the budget over which we have direct annual control. And, you know, maybe that's good or bad, but that's what we're trying to get at, is some way to show it. This is the big picture, this is, you know, on down to what part the 2.5 billion of, you know, half of it basically we have control over, and half we don't.
Well, I agree with you from a policy standpoint, but not from the standpoint of trying to sell a plan. And I think that if we don't come up with a way of representing those other funds on our plan sheet, or on a sheet that's right next to our plan sheet that looks very much like it, then what we do is we give a big loophole for people to oppose the plan for totally spurious grounds. And I guess I was talking with Hugh, and both Hugh and Annalee earlier today, and I think that the whatever the plan is, there is 30 to 40% of the population that's going to think they're going to leave Alaska within 6 years, and the best plan is do nothing. Keep spend down the reserves. So we start with a base of only 60, 65, I don't know, some percentage of the population that can accept any plan. Now, if we then create an opportunity for people who think they're going to be here to throw out our work because we don't look at their way, we don't look at the whole budget because we're only looking at the GS budget, pretty soon we don't count 50%. And so as much as I think the way we've been doing it is the right way, I guess I'm willing to make a concession to people who think throwing all of these other funds on, even though they don't contribute to the gap, somehow helps the picture. If we can hold on to those people for a little bit further and carry them toward solving the fiscal gap by including all the stuff that doesn't, I guess it's just extra baggage to carry in the report, but I'm willing to carry the baggage if I can carry them along with the plan.
I hear you.
Brian, I think you could certainly figure out a way to show the current year with all of those. And in fact, Nancy's already working on a way to show that not only for what we're doing for the 97 budget, we have a spending plan that deals with traditional stuff, as in a permanent fund and so on, and so the fiscal gap business, and then can part on down with sort of the total fixed state assets. So I don't have any problem figure out a way that we place it. Stump B was how we figure what we do in the out years in thinking about the kinds of projections used for, you know, what should we be using for ADA, for the revolving loan fund, and so on. That's where I didn't feel that I had any good ideas about what to put in the report at this point.
I've got a couple of ideas on that, and I share your frustration with trying to project some of those out 10 years, even 3 years on some of them. But it seems to me that if we put in flat federal dollars out 10 years and say that even if that changes, it's going to be a wash top to bottom. If we look at the corporation receipt expenditures, I think if we're going to be freezing state spending and bringing it down by 5% in real terms per year, we might think that we can do the same with the corporation as well. Bring that if we expect to do some restructuring of state government and save, gain some efficiency improvements, we ought to have the same expectations for the corporation. So we actually do pick up some gap filler there on the expenditure side. We already have in our scenarios built in some things filling the general fund gap that aren't necessarily general funds. Our user fee increase assumption, some of those, which goes up by $3 million a year, some of that is actually non-GF, is likely to be non-GF user fees. I don't know. I think motor vehicle license fees are all shown as GF, but some of those other user fees are not. So, well, if most of them are, I guess I'd like to look at where else there may be some fee opportunities in the non-GF, non-federal fund areas. There may be some other gap fillers out there. I don't think that we can just assume that the portion of state government which is funded by non-state, non-federal, or non-GF, non-federal funds is going to be static. In fact, there probably are some savings to squeeze out of there if we go with the retirement system change.
Part of the budget. Because just for instance, just because you have increased your highway motor fuel tax does not necessarily mean that your highways are going to get fixed. If you haven't reformed how you do business, it just means that you may end up hiring more people and be exactly where you were with potholes. That's what happens in the schools. That's what has happened in the schools consistently. We're always having bond sales here in Anchorage that say, we don't have enough room, the schools are not being taken care of, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, it's exactly as if you revisited 4 years back each time, like nothing changes. And I'm supposing that will continue, all of us being people. So, in one sense, to say that if we have a fee that increases the budget, that doesn't count as a budget increase, whoa, I don't know. How do other states do that? How do other states handle this? Does anybody know?
I mean, how do they handle showing user fees?
Well, don't they include that as part of their budget? I mean, aren't user fees part of their...
They're part of our budget also. They are part of our general fund budget, and the only reason they are shown on separate lines on expenditures here is because we were highlighting changes to the current revenue system.
Oh, I know, but I was afraid we were saying that if it was a user fee, we did not get to, and so that increased the budget, we somehow didn't get to count that as a budget increase. And it is a budget increase. You may have to not do something, you know, if you're trying to hold a flat line, maybe you might have to cut someplace else.
So the difference is whether it's a revenue increase or expenditure increase. Right now, since we're filling our budget gap with the CBR, it works picture because in the future, in some cases, our increases, let's use motor fuels as an example, process just because we increase fees, we are really putting a squeeze on the agency to get massive efficiency savings so that you could provide the same level of service for reduced dollars, or in some cases you might want to increase service like grocery for the same number.
Well, the only point I want to make again is you do also have the choice of not building new things if you're not taking care of the things you have, and
that's
in a
right.
way rewarding those people or those agencies or those organizations or those schools, school districts or university districts that choose not to fix up things and then come screaming in 7 years later and say, you know, golly gee whiz, it's so awful, and we chose not to and to do something else.
Right, and we're beginning to penalize now departments that do that. We are not in the capital budget process that we're developing now for the 6-year plan, that if they do not have O&M costs built into their out-year budget, they will not get as good a shot at getting the project. DOT is doing that, for instance, on O&M for local roads and so on. We're trying to get that
crank out of school. Yeah, this user fee business, I think, is getting way out of hand. If the state provides the service and charges the fee for it, let's talk about the recorder's office. If you go in to record a deed, you pay $15 for the first page and $3 or whatever it is for the second page. That's a service. If you have a period of time in which you have increased property transactions requiring increased services by the recorder's office, you're going to have not only increased revenue in the recorder's office, but you're also going to have increased expenditures because you're going to have to acquire the staff to perform the service in a reasonable fashion. And I think that we need to be careful when we're dealing with the service user fee issue to be clear as to what it is. We should not count user fees, as long as they support the service that's being rendered, as either a budget buster or a gap filler, simply because there is either increased or decreased activity. Most of the time you'll find that the user fees are related to economic activity, which brings me to the issue of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and ADA. Both of those organizations are primarily, with the exception of the Housing Authority portion of AHSC, were set up to stimulate private sector investment. If we say that their expenditures are budget busters, what we're saying is that we want to put the clamp on the kind of economic development ADA or AHSC can finance. But I'm not too sure that we want to make that cut. ADA has done the Red Dog transportation system, it's done Skagway Dock, it's done a lot of infrastructure things that are important, and it may very well become a useful vehicle for that, as well as other truly private sector investments. Obviously, housing, certainly in the urban areas, is pretty much keeping pace with demand. Most of the surplus housing that was created because of the crash of 86 to 88 has been absorbed, and you're seeing increments of new housing coming online. And that's in large measure because we have AHSC. If we did not have that secondary mortgage market, we would not have the kind of housing that we have in the state, and we certainly would not have enough. So I think that we need to be very careful when we assign them a responsibility for filling the gap. I don't think that the public wants that. I don't think that it makes a whole lot of sense. It might make better sense simply to get rid of them, spin them off, and let them go their merry way. But I think that if we want to curtail their activities, we tell them to pare back their expenditures by X percent. That means that they can process fewer loans, fewer rewrites, whatever. And I just don't think that it's going to make any sense. We're going to have the whole financial community down on our back, and I think justifiably so. So I don't know, Emily, how you want to handle the user fee thing, but it seems to me that that should be handled as much by narrative as anything else. But I think that we need to make sure that we explain to the public that the budget could rise because of increased user fees, simply because of increased activity.
Well, I think there are two kinds of things with increased user fees. One is the increased number of fees collected because of activity, and that should rise or fall with the level of activity. I agree
right.
with you on that.
Right.
But I think we are calling for increasing the level, the size of each fee collected in some areas to try to either more fully capture the full cost for those that are subsidized, or to create to charge the user fee which exceeds the full cost to help balance the budget. I see what is shown in our scenarios as being the latter, and that is to say, increase fees with the same level of activity. I think we have to recognize, though, there may be more activity, as you said. I don't think of those as being a problem. It's, we have to have 15 staff to process permits that people are willing to pay for.
Right.
Problem that myself.
Right, but I think that you know, if we come up with projections that show an increase, we need to make sure that we explain that, and also holding flat our bottom line total expenditures being held flat creates a problem, because it means that we basically put the clamps on a pretty severe clamp on user fee activity. So
in the draft that I dispatched to you all, I suggested that we separate and show in a separate column on our comparison those general funds where there is a one-to-one relationship between the expenditure and the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
The Badami pipeline was the best example in the 96 budget process. 1.1 of the legislative committees cut out the Badami pipeline project. Problem was, it was $100,000 of revenue to do $100,000 worth of work, and there was a net zero change in the fiscal gap, so we managed to put that back in. So what we've done now is sorted out all of the fee things, and we have extracted those where there's this one-to-one relationship,
mm-hmm.
where there's neither a subsidy as there is in, like, say, parks, general funds, sewer general funds.
Okay.
Nor is there an excess, like in motor vehicle license, where we collect 20-some million and we only spend 8 million. So I think that will address the question you're raising. And what I'm going to suggest is that any increase, those types of fees, not be considered busting the budget level that we're recommending. They, in fact, have no effect whatsoever on the that's
Judy,
not an appropriate program.
Judy, are you comfortable with that?
Well, it's interesting that the things that were used as examples are interesting, because there's something interesting going on in the state right now, and the recorder's office is a perfect example, because when I was commissioner, what, 87, 88, how long ago, that long time ago, we tried to get rid of the recorder's office, because we tried to close a bunch of them down, because obviously the private sector, that something could easily be privatized. It does. You could work it in a way that was much more efficient and much more, you know, and certain legislators did not want recorder's office. I think Fairbanks was one, shut down in their areas at all. And what they actually ended up doing then is when you have a busy spell, of course, they add a lot more people, and then those people never go away. So it does end up kicking the budget up. And Badami, in fact, all the oil industry people right now and the other resource industries are getting charged, particularly by DEC, for everything that's done. And they do add more people. And then when the job is done, those people are still there. An example right now is the stuff that's happening in Seward, the flooding. And DEC, they asked DEC to come down and do some water quality, water testing. They said, yeah, if you'll pay our people, fly us down, pay for the sampling, pay for the lab work, and, you know, pay our overtime. Well, why don't you just get a private person? What we're going to have to take a look at, if that's what's going on, then maybe this is where a perfect example of where you privatize, because what happens is it doesn't just pay for the work, it pays for a new additional work, and then when the additional work is gone, those folks are still there. So there's another side to all of this that we have to kind of watch out for.
I agree completely, Judy, that we don't want this to be used as life to staff for the high periods and not have that be flexible. If there are areas where that's going on, those are the kinds of things I need to know about, because that's not our intention in making a match work and the revenue, not for the idea of keeping it up at a higher level than what's there. So that would be a good thing to add into the section. Did you all get
No, we haven't gotten ours yet.
It should be there. I just faxed it. The governor's fax machine kind of need a Starship Commander's license to operate it, but I think it got there.
Could we move into a little bit about and in general, I think the way that Anna Lee is doing it is going to work just fine. And I think it's a really difficult problem, and the most we can do is explain it as clearly as we can and I think we're doing the best we can with it. I think Anna Lee's doing a great job trying to sort it out. Lose on the federal level, and every agency I know of now is screaming. I'm getting calls. I'm sure we're all getting calls saying, we need more money, we need more money. Will you help us? Or we can't do your work. You know, we can't have development anymore in the state unless we get some more money. So the pressure to increase spending to meet these demands is going to be very, very severe, and there's nothing there to stop it. The endowment...
What, the pressure?
No, there's no... We're saying, here's what we think you should do in terms of a budget, and here's... And yes, you can use the... You should use some of the permits on earnings reserve, but only $109 million, or only 150, you know, each year. And they're going to say, hey, golly gee whiz, we just lost $1 billion in federal funds, and the schools need 16 more million. That's what the formula program is coming up with, and we need all these things. And so, hey, the money's there, and we're running this year, and the budget just shot up to anything. To say this is a nice plan is good, but I'm wondering if there's anything that we can do to get some teeth in it, besides passing the only thing we pass laws for is in this plan is for taxes.
Well, Judy, what if we were to pass a tax bill, the income tax bill in 96, with an effective date once the annual appropriation falls below the, if we're using for this purpose, $100 million in total cuts, that the tax bill passed now, but it doesn't take effect until they actually reach that designated cut level, whatever that may be that we all agree on.
Something like that, that kind of thing where you begin to trigger in things. And maybe something else, if you're not gonna take, if you're gonna hold a permanent fund dividend, and I know we all think what the public thinks, but actually we don't know because we've never done the package thing, so we don't know anything right now. But so I'm going to talk about me. If you're going to ask me to do all these things and not use the reserves as much as I would like to use in these first years, but you want to do taxing and all that, then I want the permanent fund dividend to take a hit too. And maybe the kind, other than just hoping population will butt up against it and it increases. Because I'm not going to take the fact that we need to do anything very seriously until the non-needs-based money starts to take a bit of a hit as well. And so the fairness thing comes into play. So what if we did something like the permanent fund, we actually cap it, but we also do something like we charge an education tax out of the permanent fund dividend of $50 or $100, or so that every man, woman, and child who gets a permanent fund dividend also contributes toward education. Because right now, who you have paying for this whole thing are the people who already have jobs or have vehicles or have, because so much of our money already goes to the people who don't have in terms of corrections, health and social services, all that kind of stuff. So let's have everybody share in something everybody says is important, and that's education. So what if we did it?
I like the idea of that per capita tax, but I guess I'd like to extend it into the employment tax and capture some non-resident dollars as well, and maybe provide that. Okay, we take $50 out of everybody's dividends for an education tax, and then you pay a $50 employment tax.
Great.
But there's a credit against it if you've paid it out of the permanent fund. So you only pay it once, so that employment tax only becomes a tax on those people who don't get dividends.
I like it.
I think that the people are going to find the legislature's access to their dividends perfectly outrageous. I think that the people will be simply outraged if they see the legislature saying, okay, we're going to developed because there was that hold harmless provision that the dividend fund was paying for. I think that if you want to go into a head tax, it doesn't matter to me whether the money comes out of the guy's first month's wages or it comes, he pays it because he has the money from the dividend. But I think that the relationship between the dividend and the legislature's power to tax should be terminated. I think that it's one thing to limit the amount of the fund and the overall amount of the dividend, but once you start reaching through a backdoor taxing and hitting those dividends, you're going to find people simply in outrage. I think that the legislature won't do it. I don't like triggers, for one thing. I think that they're very dangerous. It seems to me that rather than triggering the imposition of the income tax is that we fix the time. We've made our projection. We see when it would be important for it to come into effect. And then if the legislature sees that we don't need to have an income tax, they can postpone it or defer it for another year. But remember, you're going to have about 18 months to put the whole collection system into effect, get it all set up, hire the people to do the work.
Emily?
If we reduce the dividend, the total dollar amount of the dividend below the flat line that Brad is suggesting here, what that does is actually close the gap even faster, sort of responding to what Judy was saying earlier. That we have even more of a situation where we're
then when things change in the future, the legislature can override, but
need more than just a nice plan.
One of the problems with triggers is that, you know, you can do a real minuet with these numbers for the budget and avoid the triggers. And that's, of course, what that funny little dance is that everybody does at the end of the legislature these past 2 years in terms of the CBR. And the reason why I say that we ought not to use the word trigger, although I agree with you that there ought to be something that falls into place unless performance dictates that we don't need to have that thing fall into place. And that's why I was suggesting that based on our projections, we fix a time certain, when the income tax would go into effect, request that the legislation be enacted this coming year, let it be delayed in effect, and then, of course, the legislature can defer it if our performance exceeds what our projections.
No, Mary, you don't understand. You don't understand the problem here. That's exactly what we're all afraid of, that you put the income tax in first and nothing else happens and it's just more money. No,
Judy, I'm not saying that you put the income tax in first. What I'm saying is, let's assume for the sake of argument that you put the income tax, you enact the statute in 96 or 97, you defer the effective date until 2001, 2003, whatever the projection is. When you get to that time, if you can defer the income tax further, you do so.
But there's no way you can defer it further because there's no stop on the spending. Of course you'll need it because we always need more money.
What Judy is saying is that if we put the income tax in 96 and 97, there's nothing that says there has to be a spending cut or a spending freeze during that period of time. And what I hear, Judy, if I'm right, is that you're looking for linkage between the two, Judy?
Yes, I sure am.
Yeah, I just don't think it's going to happen. And I would like to see us get, you know, a few recommendations that people can really dig, stick their teeth in. And I don't think triggers are going to make us work.
I think if it's not linked, there's no claim.
That's what
I think. Unless the thing package can hang together and the public can believe that whoever takes the first step has somebody behind them, I don't think anybody's going to want to take the first step.
I agree.
Yeah, I don't, but that's all right.
What if instead of having that, instead of trying to do the enabling legislation, income tax, in this first session, we have the first couple of years where the entire, I mean, the way we've got it set up now, the only things that are happening in the first few years are $100 million of cuts, and types of tax we identified as having other reasons to do. Alcohol, tobacco, which has public policy, expenditure reducing aspects, and a motor tax. But we use that this next few years and hold the feet to the fire to implement the budget cuts. And only at that point then do we do the enabling legislation on income tax, might then force additional savings in an effort to keep from triggering or from requiring the additional revenue from the tax.
Well, Emily, I don't like that because my fear is we make 3 years of cuts and then the legislature decides to make 3 more years of cuts or 3 more years of cuts, and we end up with basically, I believe the majority, the budget cuts are going to hit hardest at those people at the lower end of the economic spectrum who are most needy of state services. And unless that's coupled with an income tax that hits the affluent, I don't see some fairness. And for the same reason that I don't want to go for income tax without seeing budget cuts first, I don't want to go for budget cuts and dividend cuts without seeing income tax. So somehow, for me, they have to be linked in a way that's real. Now, I don't know what that is, but Judy's idea for triggers is appealing to me, but but I can't figure out easy triggers other than an effective date clause on an income tax that's effective on budget cuts. Maybe there are other, there must be a better way than that out there.
I had another problem.
Excuse me, I have a request from one member of the commission. I just saw him look at his watch for a 10-minute break. Does anybody have an objection to a 10-minute break?
I would like one. You know, it was about 73 degrees when I left the office this evening, and it's hot and stuffy in Fairbanks, and dry as a bone. How are you guys doing?
Oh, get out of here. That was
we're
so
looking
mean.
For some rain gear. Okay.
That was really mean.
We
know all the steps that need to be taken in the second 5 years from now. Years to get. Could we suggest a revisit of the fiscal plan in the year 2000 to make recommendations for what we do from that point on with much better information than we have currently?
Oh, yeah, I think we should. Where's
Brian? I'm here.
Brian? That doesn't look like you. Oh, yes, it does.
Shark.
Do you see what we're seeing? Can you see what we're seeing? We see the shark. That's cute.
Yeah.
That's good. Annalee, let me spell this out once more about what I think is going to happen here and what would be really too bad. And run through my thinking again. My thinking is that, as we say in our report, the fact of the matter is we have enough money from the constitutional budget reserve and the earnings reserve, permanent fund earnings reserve, which is excess, to continue to overspend for 2 to 4 to 6 years, depending on how much we spend. But then if it's all gone, we're in, like, deep trouble. So we don't want to do that. But if we say with this plan, here's the level of your spending, and you should start to use the reserves to fill, and then we have no way of stopping the gobbling, in the year 2000, we're going to have gobbled a whole lot more than 109 in the first year, and 150 in the second year, and 182, if I got the right one, in the third year. We're going to have gobbled, like, lots more than that, because we just do that. So somehow we have to keep, fear of triggers aside, somehow, especially if we're going to do it 5-year increments, let's figure out a way to keep them from gobbling in the 5 years and say, okay, revisit it 5 years from now. And that kind of takes care of Mary's problem too, where you worry about triggers too far out when things change.
Judy, there is a feature that we've included here now that I think addresses your gobbling question. That is, my belief that one of the big reasons why we've had this gobbling over the last 2 years is that our CBR has been so large that there's a sense of unreality that it was no big deal to several hundred million dollars to fill the budget gap, because CBR was still over $2 billion and it was growing faster than the money that was out. I think the feature of establishing a level of reserves that's necessary for what we decide to be dealing with the regular oil price volatility and the possibility of some substantial reduction in revenue there, and taking everything else off the table and putting it into the permanent fund, because we know that in the out years we need much more earnings off the permanent fund. I think that does a lot than the gobbling, because if you're a legislature that's facing the option of spending $500 million more than you can get, but you know that will draw down one-third of the CDR, I think that puts a different slant on their decision, a much more stringent test than what you've had in the last 2 years. So I think the feature of using that half on the CDR as a way of heading towards the down about the long ability to live off of the earnings should be viewed as a, at least presented as, this is one reason we're doing it. But we think there's too much patience when you've got more than a billion and a half available, or whatever number we finally decided right now.
All right. Again, when people see the package and see that there's money on the table, and that we're still asking, and that we're not going to change the permanent fund dividend, and that we're still asking for income tax, I think they're going to say, what did you guys do all summer? That somehow, at least in the, for the first 5 or 6 years, we need to put a package together that forces some of this stuff. And maybe part of the package is how much you take off the table from the permanent fund earnings every year that goes into the permanent fund. And maybe a package that says you keep the spending flat or you cut, and when you do, then income tax goes into place. But you put the whole package together because otherwise I can't imagine anybody buying in, and then you revisit in 5 years and see where you want to be. Let's do that, or let's do the endowment and let the people decide whether or not how they want to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I too have been troubled or thinking about this whole notion on billions of dollars, billions of dollars, billions of dollars in the reserves, and I guess my first very legislator-like response is spending it down to force
that's
the mechanism.
That's what I'd like.
And I think there's a lot of practicality to argue for that. I mean, that's the way kind of life in government and life in the legislature in particular has worked. But the other thing that you mentioned, it actually, if we harken back to one of ICER's modifications of its first report, using kind of the five tools, one of their alternatives the next generation alternative, was this concept of front-loading the permanent fund, waiting before the draws, which is kind of like our scenarios, and then the rationale is you really are increasing your downstream earnings off the reserve, and they quantified it, and we, in our first drafts, we weren't quantifying what we were doing in that regard. But one strategy that seems to be, I think it's perfectly rational, that would be to formalize what we're doing in depositing reserves as front loading, and it yields X in out years 6, 7, 8, and we are taking some of those extra earnings as a stream, and build that more into the overall rationale of what we're doing. And I think what, and I may have missed a beat here, I apologize, but where I last left off was seeing, kind of just for discussion purpose, these periodic deposits. I don't know, that's periodic deposits, and I know we were doing it just kind of for discussion, but it's faith.
See, everything is on faith here, and I think the business community is going to say not only no, but hell no to even the social taxes, as long as they think that it's going to be business as usual. I think the NEA and the government employees are going to say not only no, but hell no to keeping everything flat when they see all the money that's on the table. And somehow everybody has got to feel that they took a little, that incremental stuff. Everybody's got to feel that they, and the permanent fund dividend has absolutely got to take a hit too, because we keep saying we're concerned about the poor people when budgets go down. It's not the poor people usually, it's the hit through the municipalities, which means property owners and the job payers and municipalities get hit too. So somehow got to be, that everybody takes a little hit and that things begin to change. And if we cannot do that, then again, I'm going to say, I guess I'm going to end up voting for the endowment because, and letting the people take a vote on that, recommending that the legislature let the people take a vote on that, because if we can't come to grips with this in any kind of way that guarantees something happening differently than it does now, if we can't do that, then any other way, then I guess the endowment is an answer.
I'm not understanding something. One of your points, when you say that there's money on the table and you don't see the dividend going down, if the dividend goes down, there's more money on the table.
If the dividend went down more than right now, under the Rieger plan, it went down quite a bit. It doesn't happen here because there was a I guess OMB made a policy decision or something to keep it up. But we had...
fund for protection.
Mr. Chairman.